Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly storytelling event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA, Anchorage. On this hour of Arctic Entries, the truth will set us free.
We'll hear everything from little white lies that get out of hand to stories of people who have lived as imposters.
Because of mistaken identity and sometimes out of necessity.
We'll also hear confessions from people who just ended up winging it.
Hopefully telling this story in public squares me cosmically with the world. Thank you very much.
All of these stories were originally told in Anchorage as part of our monthly Arctic Entries event. And the stories from this show were told live at the Snow Goose Theater in October 2012. Our fall 2013 shows will be held at the Performing Arts Center. More on that at arcticentries.com.
We'll begin with an incredible story from Jason Slemons. Slemons is currently a developer and programming consultant in Anchorage. Let's hear what the truth did for him.
I was born and raised here, and I went away briefly to school. Actually, when I was 15, I went away for 2 months to a math camp. I'll sort of let that drop. Not just because it's 2 months and it's a math camp, but also because people go to this. So it's funny to say that. It completely changed my outlook. I liked math before, but after that, I totally loved it, and I couldn't get enough. And I went to college early to be a math major, and I went to graduate school early to go get a PhD in math. So mathematician was a very large part of who I was and still who I am. My story takes place in the fall of 2003 when I was in graduate school. I was walking to my office after having taken a class, just walking across campus, and this guy, about my age, not homeless, not crazy, just a normal guy, comes out. Oh, you know, I mean, you're a big public university, it happens. And he comes out and he stops and he says, "Hey, you have an Arsenal's jacket on, do you play soccer?" So now, a little bit, Arsenal's, for those of you who don't know, is a professional English Premier League team that I supported. And even more backstory, I did play a little bit of soccer when I was a kid. It's obviously not the most popular thing to do as a mathematician. So my peer group, let's say, didn't participate a whole lot. I didn't play a lot in graduate school, for example. But anyway, I told this guy, I was like, "Actually, yeah, you know, a little bit for rec teams and stuff." And he says, "Well, my name is Mike, and I'm the captain of the U.S. Paralympic men's national team. And we travel all over the world, and we play for the U.S., and the coaches are really great." He started telling me about this team. He said the coaches were really great. He said the fields we play on, the facilities. He said the food was really good at the training centers. He said all of it was paid. He went on and on about this team. And I'm like, "Man, this sounds great." But I really didn't know why he was telling me. Until the end, he was sort of wrapping up, and he says, "Well, I noticed that you have cerebral palsy. Have you ever thought about trying out for the team?" I'm like, I do sort of walk pigeon-toed a little, and I thought, well, maybe he was just going way out on a limb here. I'd never heard of cerebral palsy, but it definitely sounded like the kind of thing that if you had, you would know. So I told him, and he seemed nice, I wanted to be honest, but also, you know, I wanted to let him down gently. And I said, "Mike, your team, it sounds awesome, but I just don't know that I'd qualify. I don't know what cerebral palsy is, and so I feel like I probably don't have it." And so he said, "Well, Jason, don't worry about that. I'm pretty sure you've got it." "Okay, all right. So why don't you just, you know, take my email address, think about it a little, and then get back to me." And I thought, well, you know, sure. Why not? So I got about as far as my office door, and I was like, "Man, I got to see if I have cerebral palsy." So I did remember being sick when I was a kid, but I was pretty sure it wasn't that. But so I called my mom, and I said, "Mom, this guy, Mike, thinks that I have cerebral palsy. And I know I walk funny, but I think that's just how I am. And she's like, well, you remember going to the hospital when you were real young? And I says, yeah, but I thought it was for something else. She says, yeah, well, it was, but while you were there, they actually diagnosed you with cerebral palsy. And I was like, oh, awesome. Yes. Like, this is so cool. You're not going to believe what this guy Mike said about his team. So and my mom sort of defended a little bit why she hadn't told me earlier. Something like Americans with Disability Act was very new. She didn't want me to be sort of judged. There was a lot of things I probably wouldn't be allowed to do, like play a lot of soccer or hike a lot. Growing up here, those were, you know, really fun. And if I had cerebral palsy, people might think that I wouldn't be able to do those things. So I was like, well, hey, you know, that's fine, just as long as I get to play on this team now. And so I emailed Mike, and I said, Mike, look, here's the deal. It looks like I've got it. And he says, okay, all right, so just get a diagnosis, and you can come. In the meantime, you can come. You can play on my rec team for a little while. I can take a look at you. And so I did. I called the University of Missouri, I think. I think that's where I went when I was really, really young to go, because I was so sick, to go get diagnosed. And I talked to somebody in their archives, because it had been 20 years, and she said, yeah, we have your records, but we'll have to get them. If we can find them, we'll send them up to you. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, I get this package in the mail, very thick, and I read the story about this very sick boy. And I read down through all the stuff that they didn't know what it was, and then I got to the part where, yeah, I have cerebral palsy. And so then I told Mike, and he's like, okay, great, we'll, you know, play on my rec team here for a couple weeks, and I'll take a look at you, because the team's very competitive, obviously. So I did. I went and I practiced with Mike's team. I remember going out, and I was thinking, oh, I haven't played soccer in years. I probably should have, I don't know, played a little before Mike saw me. But oh well. And I went out there, and I did great. I played a great game. I nutmegged some guy, and Mike was ecstatic. He was out of his mind happy. He says, you know, Jason, this is great. You may not start right away, but you're definitely going to get to play. So cat out of bag, I had cerebral palsy, and it looks like I'm going to be on this team now. A couple of weeks later, I was invited to a tryout in Norfolk, Virginia, which doesn't sound exciting, but to a graduate student who spent their whole life in their office, that's a pretty big deal. And while I was there, I had a pretty crazy time. That's a whole other story. And then after that, I was selected to go to my first tournament in Russia. Since going to Russia, I've competed for 9 years. I've been all over the world. I'm an Olympian with about 40 international appearances. So cerebral palsy for me has been like not really a disability at all, but instead like a free plane ticket everywhere. To live this ridiculously charmed life over the last 9 years. That's it. Thank you.
That was Jason Slemons, and you're listening to Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell stories about fabrications, imposters, and winging it. Our theme is, the truth will set you free.
Each storyteller has 7 minutes to share his or her story. You may have noticed the timer during that last story. At 5 minutes, the hosts of the Live Arctic Entry show will let storytellers know that it's almost time to tie things up, and then another timer sounds at 7 minutes to let the storytellers know it's time to make way for the next speaker.
Our next story is told by Carol Holly, who has definitely been in Alaska long enough to call it home. But this wasn't always the case. Carol's Arctic Entry story is about her experience trying to fit in Galena, Alaska, a tiny city of about 500 people, on the Yukon River.
We've all heard the phrase, fake it until you make it. Thank you, Nellie. And as you know, in certain situations, this actually works. There are other times when, to put it mildly, it's less advised. When I moved to Alaska about 11 years ago, and I moved to a predominantly Alaska Native village in the middle of the interior, along the Yukon River, off the road system, about 500 miles north of Anchorage, 180 miles west of Fairbanks. And I was moving to run the environmental program for a tribe, and I just graduated from grad school. I'd never had a professional job. I was a strict vegetarian. I had never been to Alaska, let alone Galena, a village of 600 people. And I was from Daytona Beach, Florida. I was raised Southern Baptist, though I've recovered. And when I was in high school, my nicknames were White Bread and Brady Bunch. This may have been one of those times when it was best not to fake it. I unfortunately was not very wise 10, 11 years ago. So when I got this job offer, I was super excited, and I asked everyone I knew who had been to Alaska, what do I need? And they said, Carhartts. So I went out and I bought myself a pair of duck dungaree Carhartts. They were still starch stiff. There was a crease from the fold. It was great. I was so proud of those pants. And I got on the plane and I arrived in Alaska in those Carhartts from Olympia, Washington, where I had gone to the Evergreen State College. And I'd been preparing myself for my move to Alaska. I'd protested the World Trade Organization in Seattle, marched in the procession of the species for Earth Day, tossed back a couple of organic beers with Dave Foreman as we discussed monkey wrenching and Earth First. I got off that airplane, my backpack, my dog Natasha, my three cats. I was excited, okay? I was riding an optimism high. So, the most powerful lessons are often quite painful. And I remember my first week in Galena, they had this welcome potlatch. And it was wonderful. Everyone had turned out with these a vast array of traditional foods. And the chief, Peter, a really great man, he's a quick wit, quicker dance feet when we got onto the fiddle dance. He was standing behind me, helping me load up my plate. I walked away from that table with at least five, different pieces of moose meat. I was prepared in different ways. It was great. Walked up to my friend Darcy, who had just arrived from California, and I remember sitting down while all eyes, I could tell, were on us, though discreetly, and I whispered to her, I haven't had meat for 8 years. This could go very poorly. It could. But I wanted to make it here. I was really excited. I'm going to impress these people. So I tried. I tried to eat every bit of that meat. I didn't actually succeed, but I did try. There were a few pieces that may have made it into a napkin, hopefully discreetly, that I later fed to Natasha, my dog, and she was quite excited about it. Much better than my stomach, which by the time we made it back to the one-room cabin that I was sharing with Darcy, I had to rid myself completely, my body completely, of everything I had consumed that evening. I won't share with you the gory details, but I will tell you it was extremely uncomfortable. My third week in Galena, I was tasked with giving this traditional dietary food survey. I was really excited. I was going to get to talk to elders, and I was going to be able to share with them and learn what they had eaten when they were kids, what their parents had eaten, and I was going to learn about Athabascan culture. So I was really, really excited. It's been 10 years. I remember one of those interviews. I'm sure I talked to other elders. It was my job, but I have no specific recollection. I remember walking up to the front steps of the cabin of Sidney Huntington. He was 87 years old at that time. And I learned when I went to Galena that he was the man. This man was incredible. He was influential when it came to welfare, to fish and game issues, to whether there should be a road built from Fairbanks to Galena, on suicide prevention. The elementary school is named after Sidney. Needless to say, I was scared. But I walked up to the front door and I knocked, and nothing. Nothing. No sound, no movement, absolutely nothing. But something else I had learned was that Sydney is actually hard of hearing, so I knocked again and louder. Still nothing. So if I was being myself, I would have walked away, I would have come back another day, but I was really excited. This is my new job, it's my role, I'm the environmental program manager. I am gonna get this interview. So I knocked again and louder. And there was a reaction. He came out, and apparently he had been napping, and so was not exactly happy that I had interrupted that nap. But I cruised on, and I said, "Hi, my name's Carol. I'm really excited. I'm doing this traditional food survey, and this is going to help our environmental and cultural planning in the future." Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And I said, "Well, you know, this is really going to help our future generations." And he stood there, and he looked at me, and he said quietly, "Tell Regine," that was my supervisor at the time, "tell Regine if she has some questions for me, she can stop by later." And then he closed the door. And so I knew at that exact moment that faking it wasn't going to do me any good. So I spent the next 2.5 years deciding that there's this good balance between being myself and actually fitting in and being a part of this community. So I learned to cut salmon to dry and half dry while the elders laughed when I squeaked as I cut into the fish. And I learned to eat meat without getting sick. I cut caribou, I cut moose. I held a little protest outside the post office when the president invaded Iraq. I had my two dogs, they had little sandwich boards. I handed out flyers. People said, "Hey, Greenpeace." And then they asked me questions. But you know what? They were polite. They were never impolite. And it was because I was being myself and they knew it and they accepted it. And I didn't have to fake anything. Well, in the last couple months while I was in Galena, I had one last survey to do, and it was on contaminated foods. And I walked up to Sydney Huntington's door one last time, and I knocked just once this time. And he answered the door, and I explained why I was there, and he said, "Which one of my grandchildren are you?" And now, mind you, the man has 20 children and countless other grandchildren, so I didn't expect him to actually, you know, be able to know who they all were. And I was sitting there and I was thinking, I don't want to embarrass him and I really need this survey. So I said, "I'm Carol." And we sat and we had this great discussion and it was great. But now, you know, as even a good Southern Baptist, let alone a recovering Southern Baptist, I still feel quite a bit of guilt. So I'm here with the idea that the truth will set me free. And I want to apologize to Sydney. I'm not your granddaughter. I'm not from Alaska, let alone Galena. But I want to thank you for being kind and sharing your wisdom.
That was Carol Holly, live at the Snow Goose Theater in October 2012. You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
As you may know, anyone may volunteer to tell a story at our live Arctic Entries events. To find out how you can share your story, visit arcticentries.com. Our stories on this show are based on the theme, "The Truth Will Set You Free."
At each live event, we also feature music from local artists. We'll break now from stories to play a tune from Nellie Clay. This was recorded live at Arctic Entries.
Oh! Hold on, little girl. Oh, you were meant for this world. Hold on tight. Oh, you were meant for this life. We're gonna fake it till we make it. Oh, oh. Tell sweet lies until they are reality. Lie to me, darling. sweet lies, oh, lie to me. We're gonna fake it till we make it, oh, you and me. Make sweet lies into our sweet reality, into our sweet reality. So hold
You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage. And thank you, Nellie Clay, for the music. Now we'll hear some more true stories from Alaskans.
Travis Corkery was a guy with a secret. Now he's a guy with a confession. He hopes that telling his story will square things up with an unnamed Las Vegas casino.
I'm here tonight because I did a bad thing. I did a bad thing three times. In 1999, I started working here in town as a car stereo installer. That wasn't the bad thing. I started working, we would install stereos, and then we started working on other aspects of cars, customizations, and repairs and whatnot. And in about 2005, a buddy of mine and I decided that we'd taken our careers in cars as far as we could at the shop we were at, and that it was time to open up our own business. So we did, and we left our shop, and we moved to a different area. We leased some shop space from a guy who also had a shop in town that didn't do what we did, and that was August. And by December of that year, we'd outgrown our little corner of the shop, and it was time for us to have what they call in the industry a brick-and-mortar business of our own. They don't really care about the construction of your shop. It can be made out of anything you want, but if you got an address somebody can send a letter to, that's a brick-and-mortar shop. So we worked really hard. We did 90 hours a week for about 4 months there, and we saved a little bit of money and took on an investor, and we had enough money to start a shop, but we didn't have any products whatsoever to sell out of our shop. So shops that don't have products to sell don't necessarily stay open for very long either. So we'd been working really hard, we needed products, and we decided to go down in January of 2006 to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And in our minds, what we expected was we would get down there and people would want our business and they want us to sell their products, so they're going to take us out and bribe us with steak dinners and alcohol. And, you know, we expected the Vegas experience that you would have a guy like the guy on the Monopoly box. Like, that's what we wanted. We wanted cigars and... in reality, the people that you talk to, they deal with arrogant and overly ambitious kids for a living. They saw right through it, and they weren't having any of it. And if you want to buy 50,000 units from a guy, yeah, they'll take you to a show, but if you want to buy five, they don't even want to give you a pen. so we spent our first day, we walked around all the exhibits, and we met MC Hammer. His star power had faded quite a bit since 1989 or whatever. But meeting MC Hammer is better than not meeting him, so there was that. End of the day, we hadn't signed any deals yet, so we went to the casino. Have you guys been to Vegas? One of the nice things about Vegas is that if you're spending money at a table, they're going to bring you free alcohol, and they're going to do that all night long. And we went to a casino, and we sat down, and this gorgeous waitress comes up to me, and she's like, hey, what can I get you? And I really wanted somebody to believe that I was the Monopoly man, but in reality, I'm a purple property person, and so I tell her, I say, I'll have a glass of your finest scotch. And she says, we have penny slots right over there, and we don't bring scotch to the table. And I said, oh, well, what do you bring to the table? And she says, we bring beer. And I said, I'll have a Guinness. She says, we don't bring Guinness to the table. Again, we're a penny slot club here. I said, what do you bring? They bring Corona, and they don't bring anything else. So I said, I'll have a Corona with a lime. And she says, okay, limes are 50 cents. And I say, okay, I'll pay you 50 cents for your lime. And she brings me a Corona. And we had each brought, my partner and I, about $100 to gamble with each night that we were there. It was going to be four nights. And $100 doesn't go very far. Even if you cash it in at the beginning for a stack of really small denomination chips so you feel like a millionaire. And I had watched my large stack of chips turn into a small stack of chips over the course of the night. And so there I am. I got about $20 left in two chips. And I decided that it was about time to go home. I'd been drinking my Corona and limes all night long, and I was feeling pretty good. And so I put 20 on black 13. That had been a number that had served me well in life, but not so well in roulette that night. And I'm telling the people next to me, I'm like, it's mathematically impossible not to be 13 next. And I made up math on the spot, too, to justify my case. One spin every minute and 15 seconds. It's been an hour and a half since it hit. It's statistically impossible not to be black 13 the next time. And that's the Pythagorean theorem. And that's not, by the way, the Pythagorean theorem. But it worked for them, so they start surrounding my chips with their chips, and I'm on 13, and they're on the lines next to 13, and they're on the corners, and there's this huge mountain of chips right in the middle of the roulette table, and she throws the ball, and it starts spinning around, and I'm confident, and drunk, but I'm confident that it's going to land on 13, and it does. Yeah. So we scream. We yell, everything's great, it's 13. She puts her marker on the table. She starts paying everybody out. And I look at the wheel. It didn't actually land on 13. It landed on 15, but she was so impressed by my excitement that it landed on 13 that she starts paying everybody out. And I'm scared at this point. I've seen stories on TV about what happens when you cheat a casino. And so she pays us out, I don't say a word, and then I grab my chips and I go to leave because I need to be up early, but I was still Corona and lime. So I sit down at the blackjack table, and I watch my chips get smaller and smaller again. I had 700 bucks, now I'm down to very few, and I remember the incident earlier, and she deals me some cards, and she gives me, I get a 12, and so I take a hit, and then I've got a 15, and I take another hit, and then I've got a 17, and then I take another hit accidentally, and she she throws a 7 out there, and just for fun, I go, woohoo, 21! And she pays me money. So that was intentional this time, and I didn't feel bad. I felt intoxicated. And a couple hands later, I lost on purpose because I didn't want to let them know my secret. And she deals me another hand, and I stand on 17, and everybody else is under 21, and they've all stood on whatever hands they had. And then she starts flipping over her cards. It's 15, here's 17. And she throws down a 4, and it was 21. And I go, woo, busted! Everybody gets paid. And she paid us all. So the guy next to me, she says she's got to go. It's time for her to stop dealing cards, and she's going to have a replacement guy come in. And the guy next to me leans over and says, "Thanks so much for that. But if you keep doing that, you're going to get thrown out." And I say, "I'm the king of cards. You don't." So I'm the king of cards, and he tries the same trick, and the new dealer calls him on it and says, "You're out of here." Two guys from security escort him away. I say, "What was that about?" And he says, "That guy, the old dealer said that there was some shenanigans taking place at this table. He was trying to cheat us, so we threw him out." Well, so I grabbed my chips, I cashed out, I left. I run into the guy that got thrown out on the sidewalk. He says, "What happened? Why did I get kicked out?" And I said, "Well, sometimes you got to know when to hold them, and sometimes you got to know when to fold them." And I've lost money in Vegas since then. They've gotten my money back. I should be square with them financially. Hopefully telling this story in public squares me cosmically with the world. Thank you very much.
You just heard a live recording from our October 2012 Arctic Entries event. That was Travis Corkery, the king of cards.
I love how you can just tell that Corkery had a huge smile on his face the whole time he was telling that story. To hear that one again, or any story on this show, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to share their stories. Our next storyteller is Nate York. Nate's story is about winging it, how he played along and did what he had to do to get the job done.
I've been working in humanitarian aid for 15 years, and that's put me in some strange places and some tight situations. In Bosnia, I was delivering food and medicine to Sarajevo during the war. And in Liberia, I was in the jungles and ran out of drinking water. And so oftentimes I've had to think on my feet. And this is a story about winging it in northern Afghanistan. I arrived in April 2004 from Anchorage to Shebargon. It's in northern Afghanistan near the Turkmen border. I was working on construction of my 6th girls' school, and we were at the point of finishing the foundation, but because there was so much building going on in the country, prices had increased phenomenally, and I knew that we didn't have enough money. We weren't going to be able to finish the project. So I'm on the ground, and my translator, Ayub, said, "Hey, I heard a rumor that there's a warlord who's taken some interest in our project, and apparently he has 100,000 bricks that he might be willing to donate. 100,000 bricks is enough to build 8 classrooms, which is quite a bit, and that's what I needed." So Ayub said, "But the problem is this guy, he's really dangerous, and he's known as a killer. In fact, in the area, his nickname is Taliban Hunter." So the other thing Ayub said was, "And I'm also concerned because he's never taken any interest in women's education. So what I'm concerned about is if he gives us this 100,000 bricks, is he going to want something from us?" Well, at that point, I knew we were going to run out of money. I knew we couldn't finish building the school. So I asked him to set up a meeting, and several nights later, we drove out to his stronghold. We approached, and they had 14-foot walls with razor wire, and there was a steel-reinforced gate. 2 soldiers came with AK-47s and opened up the door, opened up the gate. A dog came out and tried to bite the tire of our SUV, and so we drove in there, they were expecting us, and the soldiers escorted me down several hallways to a meeting room. I opened the door and was instantly hit with this heavy cloud of hash. There was 30 soldiers sitting on pillows. They were all drinking tea and their guns were leaned against the windows. In the back, a man stood up and he beckoned for me to come towards him. This was obviously the commander. So I walked up to him, and he had these cold, dead eyes. And he reached out his hand, and he said, "Salam alaikum." And I said, "Alaikum salam." And he gestured for me to take a seat, and I sat. And one of the soldiers nervously put a cup of green tea in front of me, and I nervously took a sip. And he looked over at me, and he said in English, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from Alaska in the United States." And he said, "Alaska? Oh, I have a friend. His name Mike. He's from Minnesota. Do you know him?" And I said, no, I don't know Mike from Minnesota. And he said, "Oh, Mike, he's a good fighter, special forces. We ride horse together. We kill Taliban." And so over the next 5-10 minutes, we sat and kind of got to know each other, talked about Mike, talked about horses, talked about what it was like to kill Taliban. And I started to relax a little bit. And so at this point, he turns to me and he goes, "Do you smoke?" And I said, "Yeah, I smoke." And I reached into my jacket and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. And he just looked at me and I realized, oh, do I smoke? At this point, I don't want to get stoned. I really just don't want to get stoned. And the other thing is, I really don't want to get stoned with a murderous, killing Afghan warlord in his stronghold. But I'm thinking to myself, man, I really need these 100,000 bricks, and I don't want to offend him. So I'm like, yeah, I smoke. So one of the soldiers quickly brings a water pipe over, and he sparks up, and we're taking big hits off this Afghan hash. And I'm feeling good. I'm feeling chill. But everything starts to look a little different because I'm stoned now. I'm high. And I start to pick up different things that I hadn't noticed before. And one of them was that the two soldiers who sat directly next to him were very different than the other soldiers. In fact, they were young. They were very young. And every time he said something, they would giggle. And the other thing is they had black eyeliner on. And at one point, one of the soldiers said something to him, and he slapped him on the arm, and he called him in Persian a bitch. And so I'm like, wow, absorbing that. And then I look down at the end of the table, and there was a television, an elevated television with a video on it. And on that video was a young man dancing, and he was wearing like a yellow chiffon dress. And he had earrings on, and he had full makeup, and had little cymbals, and was dancing. And everyone in the background were militia soldiers, and they were clapping. And the guy who was videotaping then zoomed in on two hands that were clasped, and one was obviously bigger and older, and it was caressing the back of the other hand in the video. There was obviously a lot of sexual tension in this video. And so I said to Ayub, I go, "What is that?" And Ayub asked the commander in Farsi, and the commander said, "Oh, this was a party we had 2 weeks ago." So then the commander says to me, "Do you have homosexual in the United States?" And I said, "Yeah, we have homosexuals." And he said, "Do you like homosexuals?" And I said, "I don't have a problem with homosexuals. One of my best friends is a homosexual." And he smiled, and I could see his gold tooth. At this point, I realized that he's flirting with me. And so I quickly say, "But I'm married to a woman." About 5 days later, I was at the job site, and six trucks showed up filled with 100,000 bricks. The commander had met his promise. I had to get high for those bricks, but thank God I didn't have to get f***ed.
That was Nate York, live at Arctic Entries in October 2012. On this episode of Arctic Entries, our theme is The Truth Will Set You Free. We're hearing stories of winging it, fabrications, and living as an imposter.
Our last story for this show comes from Zach Mannix. He tries, and perhaps fails at times, to stay true to his rugged Talkeetna, Alaska roots.
My parents are some pretty exceptional outstanding people in my mind. Before they settled in Talkeetna and had my brother and I, my dad was a guide on Denali and my mom worked base camp at Denali. They then settled in Talkeetna, and I grew up basically without many of the amenities that most people take for granted, running water, electricity for the most of my childhood. We had a lot of roadkill moose and salmon and things like that, and generally lived the life that I imagine most people from the lower 48 think that we all live. Shortly after high school, I realized that I wanted to be as far away from that as possible, so I took basically a misguided approach to college and wound up in Fairbanks in a long-term relationship with a girlfriend who promptly after my absence replaced me with a smash-faced, bug-eyed pug named Pippin. Having grown up the way that I did, being even a partial owner of a pug, at a distance no less, was sort of a betrayal of all of the values my parents had instilled in me as a child. And I felt that whenever they looked at Pippin, the disdain that they felt towards him sort of reflected poorly on me as well. So I thought, you know, I might as well make the best of this situation. So like a rational person, I immediately moved out of Fairbanks and found myself living with my girlfriend and the pug in Anchorage. Now, as a hesitant pug owner to begin with, I was skeptical that I would ever warm to this beast in the slightest, only to realize that I made a massive and nearly immediate transformation from an outdoorsy Alaskan child into a full-blown pug-bound, or couch-bound pug person, pardon me. As pugs were bred, and selectively bred, to occupy the laps of Chinese royals during the Shang Dynasty. Their lethargy is not their fault, it's genetic at this point. And somehow that passed on to me completely. Oftentimes I would wake up late in the morning and stare directly into his big watery eyes, and we would search each other's soul for some sort of validation or confirmation that we were living happy, productive lives. And nothing could be further from the truth. At this point, both becoming a pug person requires a few things, but most of all, it requires a lack of exercise. So both the pug and I had gained a tremendous amount of weight at this point, and our shared trajectory did not bode well for a happy future for either one of us. At this point in my life, my relationship had gone on for 4 years with this woman, and most of our pain and joy seemed to revolve around this small animal. In the summer of 2009, I decided that I needed to change something. So we decided for the first time in our lives to spend a summer away from Talkeetna in Anchorage. And during this point, I decided to start exploring the local dog parks. And it turns out if you go to dog parks often enough, you will literally run into almost every size, shape, and breed of dog imaginable, pugs being no exception. And like they say, birds of a feather flock together. I always would find myself convening with other pug people at the dog park. It may have been the fact that our creatures were so cowardly that they would refuse to interact with other dogs, but needless to say, that's where we were. And so in the fall of 2009, I was invited to attend my first pug party. Being as confused about what a pug party actually is as many of you certainly are, I Googled Anchorage pug party, and sure enough, boom, there it came. And if you click on this link, it asks you a couple of questions. Would you like to spend some time with other pug people? Would you like to spend a couple of hours talking about pugs with other people that understand your obsession? As I was getting out into the world and making new friends, I felt it only appropriate to extend this courtesy to my canine companion, so we went. Now, many of you might be able to imagine somewhat of what this is like, but imagine for a moment a room that's probably less than a quarter of the size of this, packed with 50 pugs that all look nearly identical to one another. If you add into this that their preferred snack is carrots, and many of the pug owners are merely a representation or an extension of their pets, you are at a pug party. Sometimes, without any cause or reason, one pug would take off in a wild circle running around the perimeter of the building where the pug parties were held, only to be followed by at least half of the other pack of pugs. Now, pug owners, myself being no exception, were highly protective of our small beasts. And so we would worry about their conflicts with other pugs, etc. So we would try and reach into the pile and grab your specific pug, only to look at it and realize that you'd in fact made a mistake, reinsert the pug back into the herd, and go about your business. It was at these moments of near chaos that a mighty voice would ring out, the queen bee of the pug people. With an iron fist, she would command silence, and the pugs would flock to her as she would stuff carrots into their eager jaws. Often when she showed up to the pug parties, she would command a harness system with 6 to 8 of the most misshapen, blind, deaf, and obese pugs the world has ever known. And it was when I first saw her take action like this, I had a very sudden realization. Why in the hell am I here? I wondered at this point what my parents might think, seeing me in such a situation. And my world sort of flashed before my eyes, and I realized, oh my God, I need to get out of here. I need to change. So the following fall, I graduated from school and returned back to Talkeetna to get in touch with my roots. And spending time with my parents and amongst my friends and re-embracing the child that I had grown up to be, I realized that I needed bigger changes than that. Well, in the fall of 2010, I accepted a job with the legislature, effectively ending my relationship with my girlfriend and my pug after spending nearly a decade with both of them. My lovely girlfriend, who's sitting right behind me right now, yes, that's her. We often talked about Pippin when we first got together, and I think she was as revulsed and confused as my parents were by the fact that I had been a pug person, having grown up the way that I did. And I guess all I can say is that the truth of it is that I am so much happier to be telling this story to you all than standing in a room full of 50 pugs wondering why in the hell am I here.
That was Zach Mannix, live at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage. This upcoming season, live Arctic Entries events will take place each month at the Alaska Performing Arts Center.
Thanks for tuning into the show. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. There you can find information on upcoming themes, how to purchase tickets for the live shows, and details on how you too can share your story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard, the storytellers for this show, and our musical guest, Nellie Clay. All Arctic Entries proceeds are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also at our website. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSK Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
We'll leave you with one more song from Nellie Clay.
I was born a little too late, a little too late, it seems. Don't know how that I got here with all these machines. I wanna go back in time, back in time, in the old days. I want to live back in time, the old ways. Now I could write a song about all that's wrong and how cities make me want to scream. It's not a song about all wrong. No, this song's about a dream. I wanna go back in time, back in time, the old days. I wanna live back in time, back in time, the old ways. In this dream, a violin sings and everything's in black and white. The air smells like a jack pine tree and a smoke from a fire. I want to go back in time, back in time, the old days. I want to live back in time, back in time, the old ways. I'm here to know the rivers flow, sleep under a big black sky. But I was born too late, wrong time, wrong place. Born too late, by and by. I wanna go back in time, in the old days. I wanna back in time, the old ways.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's been an introspective year for me on a personal level, and I've been contemplating mortality and immortality and all the things that make us who we are and the mark that we make on the world and the short time that we're here. And that's all of these people on the stage and all of you out here tonight. And this is my story. It's called What Are They Gonna Say? What they gonna say after you're gone? Oh, what they gonna say? What they gonna say? Will they sing your songs after you're gone? Oh, what they gonna sing? What they gonna sing? Oh, what they gonna sing? What they gonna sing? I wanted to write down just a few. Though I know I leave no one behind, oh, I want someone to know. I tried real hard, oh, I tried so hard not to lose my mind. What they gonna say after you're gone? Oh, what they gonna say? What they gonna say? Will they sing your songs after you're gone? Oh, what they gonna sing? What they gonna sing? What they gonna sing? What they gonna sing? Now my daddy died not that long ago. Lifetime of working and what you got to show for the lessons you learn. A little too late, oh, what they gonna say when you're gone? I say tell all the babies I never gave up, oh, I never gave up, forever on a love. Tell them I know at times I drink too much, but never for sorrow, only for love. Oh, never for sorrow, only for love. Tell them their mama hauled all the water. She kept the fire burning all through the night. She always and ever dreamed of tomorrow. She kept the fire burning all through the night. Tell them their mama hauled all the water. She kept the fire burning all through the night. She always and ever dreamed of tomorrow. She kept the fire burning all through the night. Oh, she kept the fire burning all through the night. I toasted you with your unfinished booze. Outside the church and right from the bottle. Okay. Your heavy heart's in my hands, but you're too hard to follow. Now my heavy heart's in your hands, but you're too hard to follow. She loved it all till the end. Oh, she loved it.